Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As you no doubt know, today is Equal Pay Day. It's the day many women have had to work into 2017 to equal what their male counterparts earned as of the close of last year. On average, women are paid 80 cents on a man's dollar across the nation and employment categories. In Hawaii, it's a little better, 84 cents. But when the majority of women populate a sector, service jobs, for example, women often face both low pay and a sense of disconnection from other women working in jobs where there are male counterparts. Either way, it constitutes a tough sell to employers. We called UH professor Monisha Dasgupta, who teaches a course in Women in Work this semester, to see whether Equal Pay Day makes a difference when we see in practice what women really face throughout the country.
Thank you, Bethan, for having me on the show. Yes, it indeed does. It does make a difference to talk about equal pay, and it does make a difference to observe Equal Pay Day. This is because oftentimes when we confront people with the reality of the gender gap in pay, it is often met with skepticism, and sometimes it's even dismissed. And to give you a recent example, last month I was approached by local public school students in the sixth grade, and they wanted to learn more about the gender gap in pay. And this was because they had actually done the research on the issue. They made a brochure and they went out to raise public awareness at a farmer's market. And their efforts were met with skepticism, and some adults even laughed at their efforts.
They really laughed at them?
They did. And to the students' credit, they persisted. They reached out to me and they wanted to know more about the issue.
So what did you tell them that maybe better armed them to go out the next time to talk about equal pay?
Well, we went over the facts of the gender gap in pay, and we said that it harms not only women, but both men and women. And this was a point that my colleague Colin Moore made on your show last week, because we see that particularly for working class families and female-headed households, the wage gap has an impact over the woman's life course, right? She saves less, her social security payments are less, her ability to retire and support herself after she retires is impaired. So these financial implications are borne by other family members and even by the government. So we talked about the ways in which this is a social issue and should not be only treated as a women's issue. So we did that, and I discussed also, you know, my surprise when I first came to the United States in the 90s, my surprise at the discovery that there was such a huge gap in pay along gender lines here in the United States. In the women's movement in India, the gender gap in pay is a huge issue. And, you know, for them to get these kinds of comparative perspectives also helped.
When we talk about the gender gap, we're also looking at women who are in jobs which are dominated by women. And very often those women feel that they not only have to deal with low pay, but in some ways they are disenfranchised from other women who have a higher ceiling because there are men in their fields. How do you look at these women in the context of Equal Pay Day?
That's a really great question, Beth Ann. We know that women and men in occupations that are dominated by women, or what we call feminized occupations, get paid less than workers who are in male-dominated occupations, right? For example, in, I think, 2014, the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed that women who worked in women-dominated occupations made 23 cents to the dollar of workers who were in male-dominated occupations. So one of the implications of that, and this speaks directly to my research interest in the low-wage service sector jobs where women of color and immigrant women are overrepresented, is that all workers get the short shrift because their wages are depressed as a result of the gendered nature of these occupations and the pay gap it produces. So in other words, all workers are affected when we see that jobs that are dominated by women are, you know, less compensated than jobs that are dominated by men. So, for example, food preparation and serving nationally is among the 23 female-dominated jobs in the bottom earning decile. So it affects all workers, and this is one of the ways in which we can look at the wage gap and, you know, what we call the sticky floor phenomenon, where, you know, it's very difficult to move these workers up the socioeconomic ladder without social policy interventions.
That also brings us to a conversation about the minimum wage, because the fight for 15 has been going on in several states. We've sort of been dancing around it a bit in Hawaii. Many businesses say, well, we can't afford to pay people that kind of a minimum wage. We're going to lose jobs. We're not going to be able to employ the very people who need to have these jobs. Does that really hold weight when you look at it over time and over the course of the nation?
One of the really interesting facts about the gender gap in pay is that we see a narrower gender gap when we compare minimum wage workers. So this is really interesting, right? And we see this narrower gap because there is a pay floor. You know, states and local governments have an enormously important role to play in terms of getting that pay floor up. So the Fight for 15 then becomes a very important campaign. And I think that, you know, along with other sorts of remedies that we pursue to address the gender gap, such as, you know, better enforcement of laws that prohibit gender-based pay discrimination or pay equity adjustments, as well as state-supported, you know, caregiving, we need to fight for 15. I think that we really need to advance, you know, that struggle, because across the board nationally we have seen that the Fight for 15 will actually improve worker productivity, will help our economy, will improve people's quality of life. And it's a really important struggle for states and local governments to back.
For women, though, who are in careers and then find themselves mid-career, very often that's accompanied by not only child care or child rearing responsibilities, but that also may include elder care, women who are caught in the sandwich generation that keeps perpetuating itself. What happens to those women when you look at them through the lens of the gender pay gap?
Again, you know, really interesting, Bethan, because when we look at mid-career women, nationally, the data starts to look really depressing. We see that mid-career women actually earn 81 cents to a man's dollar, and working women make 75% of what working fathers make. So that's like three-fourths of what working fathers make. That's you know, very consequential. And we see that these effects of the gender gap become even more profound when women have to support their children by themselves as single mothers on a lower income. You know, again, social policies that expand childcare. I think that our state is a leader in some ways in that. Our struggles around unionization have put issues of childcare on the front burner long before anybody was thinking about it on the continent. So I think that we can draw on this progressive history of our state and really sort of put our weight behind demands for expanding childcare. And I also want to make a plug for a bill that is going through the legislature right now, which is the Kupuna Caregivers Program, which will give those who take care of the elderly the ability to stay in the workforce because they will be able to get subsidized care to take care of the elderly. So these programs are enormously important in terms of bridging the gender gap, Bethan. I cannot overemphasize the importance of these social programs.
We began the conversation by looking at whether or not a day like Equal Pay Day really matters. We've seen the Equal Pay Act that was passed almost 60 years ago.
Right.
We saw Lilly Ledbetter. Now yeah. There's the Paycheck Fairness Act that's in Congress yet to be passed.
Mm-hmm.
We see so much that has looked like, at least on paper, that there was going to be some progress, but it hasn't necessarily translated into great progress in practice. What do you think will have to happen to make it actually a reality?
So I think that we have to tackle this at several levels. So one of the things that we talk about, you know, as academics is that there has been a huge revolution in work. So women's labor force participation has gone through the roofs. We are in the labor force in greater numbers than ever. And you made this point in your show last week. So we have revolutionized work, but we haven't revolutionized gender ideologies, right? So that's a cultural shift that we have to make. We have to sort of think very closely about who does work, what work, and how we compensate that. So that's at the cultural level. And that cultural level will have to sort of feed into the policy level where we need to, you know, keep persisting in pushing through policies that help working families, that respond to these major shifts that we are seeing, both in terms of our work and in terms of our family responsibilities and caregiving. So these are two levels at which the fight has to happen. And I want to give a big shout out to those sixth graders who reached out to me. And they give me so much hope, because it is that next generation that we, you know, rest so much hope in. And they're the ones who went out and tried to raise awareness, and they continue their research and they continue to inform themselves and inform others. So how inspiring is that, Bethann?
For today, that's a great inspiration. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bethann. Have a good day.
Professor Monisha Dasgupta teaches in the UH Departments of Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies. Her research focuses on U.S. migrant-led movements for social justice. Her published work includes documenting the struggles of immigrant domestic workers for fair working conditions and the Bill of Rights in New York City. This semester, she's teaching a course on women and work.
Support for The Conversation comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Henry Capono and friends perform The Songs of CNK, a tribute to the music of Cecilio and Capono, this Saturday in Castle Theater. MauiArts.org.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, taking the very long view, 1,000 years into the future. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
As today is Equal Pay Day, we wanted the backyard quiz to feature one of Hawaii's prominent women. And since we'll be speaking with a renowned female scientist later in the program, we decided to make an accomplished scientist from Hawaii the subject of our quiz today. The woman we're thinking of was a prominent educator and ethnobotanist born in Hana, Maui, who became the first Native Hawaiian woman to receive a Ph.D. in the field of science. She got that doctorate from the University of California, Berkeley, in 1950 after graduating from Kamehameha Schools and UH Manoa. She was renowned for her expertise on Hawaiian seaweed, or limu, having discovered and cataloged over 200 species. She was known as the First Lady of Limu, and today we're looking for her real name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Aloha. This is Laura Thielen. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Where will we be 1,000 years from now? Will we, the human race, be anywhere? It's all too easy to see today's world as a world on the brink. Dr. Louis G. Herman is the author of Future Primal, a book that argues that the key to a viable, sustainable future lies in our distant past. He's part of a panel this evening whose theme is Still Here, Personal Truth Quests for Urban Survival, and he's with us in our studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Chris.
It really seems as if the moment we're in today, historically, we have both the seeds of our imminent destruction and the seeds of our salvation coexisting
right
at the same time.
Right, exactly.
Who's going to win?
Right. Who's going to win? Well, I think we've really, the key to winning is to recognize that the apocalyptic scenario, which we were talking about a little bit before, is real and it's imminent, and to feel that urgency of the destructiveness of our current way of life, industrial civilization on the planet. We've really reached a turning point. There is no way that our mode of living, which is essentially based on short-term, selfish pursuit of profit, is adequate to handling the impact of 7 billion human beings armed with industrial technology.
Dumping plastic into the ocean, taking fish out to the point where, as you were telling me earlier, plastic will soon outnumber fish.
Right. I mean, the World Economic Forum estimates that by 2050, there will be a greater mass of plastic in the world's oceans than biomass of fish. We're running out of fresh water by 2030. The United Nations, the latest report on fresh water, has calculated that demand for fresh water, this is drinking water, will overshoot supply by 40%. About more than half the world's population is drawing water from underground aquifers at an unsustainable rate. Deserts are expanding in 100 countries across the world. So there's absolutely no way we can continue on this trajectory. This requires a different way of thinking, a different way of making decisions, radically different way of making decisions.
What gets us there?
We've got to take a big picture. We've got to look back into the deep past. We've got to understand who we are, where we come from, and get an idea of where we'll go if we don't change our course, and where we could go if we understand our true nature, which is a creature produced by 4.5 billion years of evolution on Earth that is capable of knowledge and choice, that human beings are defined by their capacity for self-reflective consciousness, their capacity to actually be aware of themselves and be aware of their own consciousness as the condition for learning. And that gives us freedom. We can choose. And that freedom has real consequences. It's not free unless we're free to screw up. And we are clearly doing that. We know that in our personal lives, that our choices depend on our knowledge. As a species, we are not doing that. We don't have a model of decision-making. We don't have an economic model and a political model where decisions are made on the basis of wisdom, on the basis of understanding the big picture and our deep nature.
There are ample reasons to believe that we're moving in the direction you describe. But the thing that dogs me is, will we get there in time?
It's
the
a
momentum
real question.
Seems to be going in the other direction.
Absolutely. Certainly on the surface, definitely going in the other direction. But this is the nature of the sort of massive turning point that we're facing in the history of civilization. And not only the history of civilization, the history of humanity on the face of the earth. I mean, if you think 10,000 years ago, we were all living, our ancestors were living as hunter-gatherers. We were living in pristine wilderness. Everything was organic. Everything was in its exquisite natural Garden of Eden state. We are living in small bands, caring and sharing.
Which were sustainable because we acted on our primal nature to create sustainable societies, self-supporting, supporting and caring for one another. So we're capable of it. We as humans are capable of it.
Right. There was a template which kept these societies really stable for about 100,000 years. I mean, it seems as if our best understanding of human emergence, I mean, this is also quite mysterious how this happened, but we know quite a bit about that leap into modern human consciousness, which happened between 200 and 100,000 years. And then human societies remained relatively small based on caring and sharing until about 10,000 years ago, and in a relative balance with the natural world. But there was no sense of the global reality of what planet Earth was, of the deep history of the Earth, that the Earth itself has been evolving for almost 5 billion years. and is part of a solar system, part of a galaxy, part of a universe that has been evolving for 14 billion years. This is now presenting us with an image of radical change being built into the structure of reality. So these societies cease to become viable as hunting-gathering societies because of human population explosion around 10,000 years ago when agriculture started.
Mm-hmm.
The classical civilizations only developed after about another 5,000 years. So they've only been around, you know, since 3,000 BC.
The blink of an eye in historical terms.
Absolutely. And what has been happening all the time is a separation from that intuitive understanding of our earthly nature, the fact that human beings are actually produced by a living, evolving earth. That was central to the understanding of hunting-gathering societies and has been retained actually by most indigenous societies. So what is so exciting now is that we all waking up to understand that our form of life now, that the story that we've been telling us that organizes our economics and our politics is no longer viable. We've reached a dead end, and that we can now look back and look at those societies that marked that turning point where we separated ourselves and our thinking from the earth, from the larger picture. And that is converging with the revival of indigenous wisdom and indigenous cultures. We see that in the Hawaiian Islands with the revival of hula, of Polynesian, sure, celestial, deep ocean navigation, and so on. And so we're starting to reconnect with that old wisdom and then integrate that with the best understanding that we're getting out of science and scientific cosmology to help us plot a way forward. This is just beginning.
It's just beginning. Meanwhile, the very forces that have put us in the mess that we're in are very firmly at the controls right now.
Right. Right. And I think this is symptomatic of a crisis situation, that we've essentially been following a storyline, an idea of what human nature is and how we should make our decisions, which emerged out of the 16th century collapse of feudalism. I don't want to go into too much of a detailed history lesson, but what is fashioned in the 17th century was a sort of a coherent answer to the questions of how we should live. And they came from philosophers like Locke and Hobbes and Adam Smith. And it was essentially an idea that human beings are selfish, acquisitive, aggressive, competitive, that we should have a form of government which would protect private property and protect the freedoms of the individual, essentially a society based on freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
Very little thought given to responsibilities for the whole, to the necessity for cooperation, and to the role of service and meaning in human life. It was essentially materialistic and essentially individualistic. This story is no longer working. We're waking up to the fact that we've been living a story which was written for us centuries ago in a completely different reality. And so new storytellers are emerging. A big part of the new story that allows us to connect all societies and all religions and all ethnic groups on the planet is the story coming out of evolutionary cosmology, which tells us that every human being on Earth is part of a single species. We are all intimately related. The DNA in every single human being on Earth can be traced back to ancestors of the Sun Bushmen in Southern Africa, the oldest indigenous culture on the planet, mm-hmm, still surviving. Barely. And so this is starting to give us a new understanding of what it means to be human and what human life is about. And then you can dig deeper and you can examine the ways of life of these early societies with that sort of template that created such a successful species. You can see how constricted, how deformed our current story is, the current story that's operating. And you can also see that those who have benefited the most from it, in other words, the power, the political and economic elites, and those who've invested the most in it, are going to double down at that moment when it's most threatened. And that is the moment that we're in now.
Yeah.
And so what you see is an intensification and exaggeration of the simplest, crudest,
Worst impulses,
and the most damaging aspects of that story.
Well, in my desperation to extract good news from what you're saying, what I'm hearing is that the roots of our salvation, are the template, is already there. That seems to be what you argue in your book.
That is so exciting. The information is there, and the key is understanding that what defines us as a species is actually our capacity to learn, our self-reflective consciousness. That is the great takeoff point 100,000 years ago, between 200 and 100,000 years ago. And that means that the journey, the next frontier is the frontier of consciousness. It's not colonizing some planet in some impossibly ambitious, hyper-technological utopia. Yeah. It's a matter of exploring what we've neglected for the last 10,000 years in many ways. And that's the inner realms, the outer reaches of inner wilderness, what I like to call the unexplored reaches of consciousness.
At least it's something that's available to us and not, you know, galaxies away. Thank you so much for coming in.
That was a real pleasure, Chris. Thanks.
I really enjoyed it. Dr. Luigi Herman is the author of Future Primal. He'll take part in a conversation with Bonnie Kahapea Tanner, Ko'olaupoko-based voyager and educator, and artist Solomon Enos this evening at 6 o'clock at the Surf Jack Hotel and Swim Club in Waikiki. And you can get details of that discussion on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from handcrafted restaurants, celebrating the craft of food, drink, and merrymaking at Monkey Pod Kitchen by Merriman in Ko'olina, Oahu, and Wailea, Maui, and at Moku Kitchen, now open in Kaka'ako.
And now a reality check we hope that won't be part of your life or ours. Rat lungworm disease. Civilbeat.org has been reporting on the cases now found on three islands. Chad Blair is on the line. Hi there.
And so far, rat lungworm disease free. But this report we have up today, by the way, it's from our Maui contributor, Tad Bartimus, who lives in Hana. And she's talking about, at first, when she started hearing about this disease, it was on the Big Island. It was a few years ago. She's on Maui. She's not worried. Then she hears about an alien slug on Maui. And now she's actually got two friends who are sick with this disease, which is transmitted. And there is a concern that it could be spreading to others. So far, the Department of Health has identified about 58 cases. Most of them are on the Big Island, but there are on Maui as well, and I believe Oahu too. And it's a concern.
When people hear about things like this, I mean, the natural impulse is to say, okay, that's it for the salads. That's it for the produce. Go running around the garden and this time making sure you're using gloves and tongs in case you come up against this critter. But is there really something that we can do? Because a lot of people enjoy their vegetables, and it's sad to think of here we are coming into spring and summer, lots of lovely produce, and being really concerned and giving it the fisheye when you're at the farmer's market.
Right. You certainly shouldn't be walking through your garden or your yard barefoot. And you said use gloves and tongs. Don't squish these slugs with your fingers. Wash your greens. Wash your fruits and vegetables. This is coming from slugs and snails that are eating the waste of rats. And then they become carriers of a parasite. And then it can actually migrate to the human brain. And you can get meningitis, a type of it. Just a couple of symptoms to watch for: severe headaches, neck stiffness, sensitivity, paralysis. It is potentially lethal. And so far, Beth Ann, there actually is no cure other than palliative care, taking painkillers and antibiotics, maybe some steroids. So it is a serious problem. So, yeah, don't give up on the salads. Don't give up on the greens. But be careful that they are coming from a good place. We like to go organic, but we also want to stay healthy.
Some of these creatures can be so tiny that you can miss them really easily. Is there something that you should be washing greens in? Is there a solution, a vinegar solution or something else that would ruin them?
That is something that is proposed as well. And by the way, if you go on Tad's story, which is up on our site today, you'll actually see pictures of the slug. They are very small, but if at least you know what they're looking for and where they might be, that can help you track them down and, frankly, to kill them, because they are not something that we want making us sick.
Right. So no dark little moist places where they can get out of the sun. Make sure you even check things that have the mucus slime on it, because I understand that can also be a carrier.
It can. Yeah, do not have a cluttered yard. Make sure everything's clean and orderly, because they are sneaky little suckers.
Okay, I have some work to do when I get home.
There you go.
Thanks so much, I think.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Stay healthy, okay?
You too. Talk to you soon. Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today featuring reporter Chad Blair. This week in Paris, a private collection of priceless artifacts from Oceania will hit the auction block. The three-day sale will see new owners for the 1,100 pieces formerly owned by Rainer Werner Bach. But as it is now, Bishop Museum will not be among them. The museum says it does not purchase cultural objects from the private art market. The objects could, however, be donated by a third-party buyer. That may be wishful thinking. Meanwhile, for others in the Hawaiian community, including historian Nanette Napoleon, this auction and the recent sale of items by the Princess Regina Kawananakoa estate bring up a larger issue, the cultural rights of a people to its own art. Nanette Napoleon joins us now by phone. Aloha.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Nice to hear from you again.
Good to talk to you, too. We've seen this go on now for centuries. It's not as if, you know, people are just suddenly collecting art from Polynesia or Hawaii, you know, Hawaiian art or art from wherever. And clearly, when we've seen what happened even this, in the Second World War, where art was confiscated and then, in some cases, never made its way back to its former owner, the idea is still out there of who does this really belong to? As you look at these recent sales, what are your feelings?
Well, I have mixed feelings about what's going on in conjunction with the Bach sale auction, but also because this, like you said, this has been going on for a long, long time since Captain Cook first arrived here in 1778, and it's been a wide disbursement of Hawaiian cultural artifacts all over the world. So this is, and these artifacts have made their way into various auction houses and antique shops and many other places and changed hand many times. So it has become an issue for especially Native Hawaiians who are trying to protect cultural artifacts and keep them in Hawaii.
On one hand, there's the idea that, well, if these things are far-flung, then it will expose more people to them. And we'll be able to make the point that this is also art and it comes from a specific place on the planet that maybe most people will never get to see. On the other hand, depending upon what those objects are, they could be of great importance to families here in Hawaii, for example, or other places. I remember when we talked about the Forbes Cave incident long, long ago and how important those objects were to get back. And a real battle over getting some of them back. As you look at now what we've seen happen very recently with the Kawananakoa sale and other sales that may happen, should museums be stepping up, even though, as the Bishop Museum told us, it will not buy private objects?
Well, that's a dilemma for many museums, especially indigenous museums that have large indigenous collections. Is it ethical to purchase cultural items, indigenous items? And so that debate has been going on for many, many years around the world in different museums and auction houses. And if you go online, you can see the dialogue going on. You can find articles going back decades and to today talking about this issue. But for Hawaiians in particular, because during the 1800s and early 1900s, we lost so much, thousands and thousands of our cultural items to disbursement. And some of it was legally sold to somebody else. Some of it was loaned. Some of it was traded. But the fact remains that they were gone out of our realm, and for research today and people trying to revive Hawaiian culture, we depend on those objects greatly that are in collection in public collections that we can access and look at and study, as opposed to being in private hands where they're locked away in vaults or under strict climate control conditions, and you can't access, the public can't access them. So it's a source of very serious grievance in the Hawaiian community that people who have such collections do not step up to the plate and do the right thing. What we think, and I'm Native Hawaiian, think they should do is to put them in the public domain through museums.
Some collectors have said, well, you know, when I'm no longer on the planet, that's the plan. They'll be released to a museum where many thousands of people over time will be able to enjoy them. But while someone is alive, they may want to have a private collection. Is there a role here in public policy for assessing who should have what rights to what artifacts?
That's a sticky wicket, and there is some legislation right now has been proposed because of what's happening with the Paris auction. Representative Ng from the island of Maui is talking about proposing some kind of legislation to address this issue in some manner. I'm not sure exactly where he's going, but it's something that should be discussed more and see if that's some place that needs to be gone to or can be gone to. I'm not sure. I'm still on the fence about that issue.
We've seen nations sort of go at it with each other about who owns what when one has had artifacts that belong to another's culture. And in some cases, that has crossed the lines into policy from one nation to another. But now, as you look at what things are still out there and available, is there something that you would ask a private collector to do, or someone who cares deeply about it? Or is there a movement within the Hawaiian community to, in fact, purchase some of these items again to be able to donate them, say, to Bishop Museum?
Well, over the years, as I've been watching this story, this situation, there have been many auctions that have come to fore, which include Hawaiian cultural artifacts. And there's always been a cry, hue and cry in the Hawaiian community, and from non-Hawaiians, in fact, that say, oh, you know, what a pity. Somebody in Hawaii should be stepping up to the plate here. The Hawaiian community should be rallying and pulling the resources to buy these objects as they come up. But very, very few times has that actually happened. And they've just gone out to the world instead of coming back in some manner to Hawaii. And then you have the issue of, okay, so Hui gets together and buys an object or several objects, and now they have them, and what do they do with them? How are they going to curate them and make it publicly accessible?
Well, at this point, with the auction happening in Paris tomorrow through Thursday, we'll have to, I guess Friday, we'll still have to wait and see what happens with that, and if any of these objects ever make it back home, as
yep,
you would
yep.
say. Thanks so much for the time today.
Okay, you're welcome, Beth. Yeah.
Nanette Napoleon is a freelance historical researcher from Kailua, Hawaii. She assists other researchers finding archival information about topics relating to the history of Hawaii. And now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz and give you the answer. We asked you to name one of Hawaii's greatest scholars. She was the first Native Hawaiian woman to receive a doctorate in a scientific discipline. Her field of study was limu, or Hawaiian seaweed, and she authored more than 150 publications and 8 books on that subject. After teaching at Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station, our scientists moved back to Hawaii, where the University of Hawaii hired her to study ethnobotany, or the interaction of humans and plants. It was during this period that she pioneered advancements in the study of seaweed and earned the nickname the First Lady of Limu. In 2005, she was named a Living Treasure of Hawaii, a distinction she bore until her death in 2010. Her maiden name was Isabella Iona, and she was known by her married name, Isabella Iona Abbott, for most of her career.
And Beth Ann, Terry George in Waikiki knew the answer. He was the first of many to call us, including one caller whose daughter worked with Dr. Abbott, 3 others who have read her books. So that was quite a popular quiz. And that's it for today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, we encourage you to send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Dr. Hope Jaron was driven to a life in science by her sense of wonder, fueling her dedication with a lifetime of study in geology, soil science, and the specialized fields of geochemistry, geobiology. Her study of fossilized plants has expanded our knowledge of the distant past, and her popular memoir, Lab Girl, has extended our understanding of women in science. She's coming to Maui this weekend. She's on the line with us now. Dr. Jaron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, sure. Let me address your scientific work, because I think it's kind of fascinating the way you've been able to learn from fossilized plants, yeah?
Yes.
What was it that led you in that particular direction? It didn't seem as if that much had been studied before you started work on that area.
Well, I got interested in plants because I'm interested in the moment when the geological becomes the biological. We mm-hmm. call that geobiology. But I'm interested in how the raw materials of the geological world, water and sunshine and the atmosphere, the moment when they turn into living cells, and that happens inside a leaf. It happens inside the leaves and the trees and grasses and the plants that are all around you, and that makes the base of our food chain. I'm interested in that moment of transformation and how it has changed in character over long periods of time as the availability of those resources have changed. And I'm also interested in how it might change in the future in terms of how we are changing the climate and the resources available on the surface of the earth.
Well, it sounds like you're kind of describing the birth of life, yeah?
Yes, it is the first biochemical step that turns the raw ingredients of the world into the living tissue. That's the base of the food chain. It's that chemical process.
Well, that's what's not to be interested in, right? But as you say, that's changing, and some of those changes are a bit troubling, aren't they?
Well, the raw materials for life are changing. Mm-hmm. It matters what the temperature is and what the composition of the atmosphere is and the availability of fresh water. And we know from climate change that those are main things that are being affected. I study what happens on land, but of course there's plenty of folks interested in how the ocean is changing. And when we change those ground rules for how life works, we change the balance of competition all the way up the food chain and into our own lives as we look at obtaining food and medicine and building materials, wood, and all the other wonderful things we get from the earth.
You know, there seem to be 2 sort of parallel motions in the world of science, and one of them good and one of them a bit disturbing, and one of them being, of course, the accumulation of additional knowledge about the origins of life and how we can sustain it. And also, but there's also a denial. As that information comes in, there seems to be a growing movement of denial of science, denial of proven facts. How do you get around that?
Well, to me, that reflects basic issues around trust. I think science and government and medicine have to ask themselves very hard questions about why doesn't the public trust the information that we believe strongly in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to face up to the fact that there are very good reasons in the past for when that trust was misplaced and when it was violated. That's a very big issue you're touching on.
Yeah.
But I think that's what's at the root of the resistance we see to really doing something about climate change.
In part, I would think one of the seeds of that destruction you describe is science kind of selling itself out, you know, becoming in the service of somebody wanting to make money.
Well, science is an interesting thing in that we do it for all kinds of different reasons. We do it in order to make a better product and stronger bridges and cures for diseases. But really, in the scientist's daily life, we do it because it brings us joy.
Yeah.
And what happens down the road is something we may not be thinking about at the time. When we work, we're generally pursuing curiosity and trying to teach others to do the same thing.
But that, are you saying in a way that refusal or failure to think about what happens down the road has gotten science in a bit of trouble?
I think often we see discoveries that are used for both good effect and for more unfortunate things. You know, if we look at agriculture, we need to grow food so people can eat. But there's also a question of where we turn over land, where we take away natural settings and turn them into agricultural settings and the people and animals and plants that are affected. I don't think we do ourselves any favor by saying, is this good or bad? What we often see is that we're somewhere in the middle. We've got to learn to live somewhere in the middle with all these contradictions. And we don't just leave the land perfectly alone. We need things from it. We need food and shelter. But that doesn't mean that we can treat the land any way we want to, that there's a thoughtful middle to how we should responsibly live on Earth. That's what I believe.
Before you can start thinking about is this good or bad, your primary role is to think, is this true or false, right?
Yes, there is that. Judging information and using my skills that I learned from other scientists to tell me, you know, is this true or false? And then my job is to share what I know. I do believe my job is not to tell people what they should think, what they should believe. It's to share what I've learned and be honest about how I learned it, what I know and what I don't know, and trust that people will form their own opinions and act in their own best interests.
Well, let's hope your hope is justified. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much.
Dr. Hope Jaron is the author of Lab Girl, for which she was awarded the National Book Critics Circle Award for autobiography. She'll be speaking at a Merwin Conservancy Green Room event this Friday at 7 p.m. in the McCoy Studio Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
There's always a great deal going on in our state that's maybe just a little bit under the radar, and that's where we count on Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama to keep us up with such events. And one of them involves one of our own, Derek.
I know. This was under everybody's radar. Yeah. I didn't know this until I read it this morning. HBR's own arts and culture reporter Noi Tanigawa will be one of four people who will share their work and their thoughts on Hawaii as a thriving center for art, design, and architecture. This is happening tomorrow at the Surf Jack Hotel Waikiki on Lewis Street. Other panelists include architect and urbanist Sean Connolly, Tamara Rigney, she's the owner of Paiko in Kaka'ako, and New York-based art collector Cristiano Cairati, I believe. Mm-hmm. Once again, it's the Surf Jack, but you need to RSVP, and you can find out more on our website.
A number of those talk story events going on. We've already alluded to a couple on today's show.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And UH Manoa is offering a free lunchtime concert. Can't go wrong with that.
No, not at all. And it's Music at Art, and that's a collaboration between the university's departments of music and art history. Concerts feature performances by guitar and instrumental students. So bring your brown bag lunch and relax and enjoy the music. It's from 12:30 to 2 p.m. in the UH Manoa Art Building, ground floor courtyard.
Sounds pretty good, Derek.
Yeah.
And a group that's interested in stitchery design will have a monthly meeting. Never
yes.
knew these guys existed.
They've been around since 1974.
Uh-huh.
The Hawaii Stitchery and Fiber Arts Guild will meet tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Honolulu Museum of Art School, 1111 Victoria Street. They meet on the first Wednesday of every month. And one of HBR's longtime volunteers, Bonnie Pastana, is also a member of the guild. And if you want more information about this, you can visit hsfag.org.
Fair enough, Derek.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to do it for us for the conversation for today. We will be back with you tomorrow talking with immigration attorney Claire Hannes, looking at the pause in the Hawaii versus Trump lawsuit.
And a surfing legend turns to snowboarding.
You can let us know about what you think of any of our guests or the topics that you hear on the show. All you have to do is call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 and leave us your comments there. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed the part of the conversation or any other show we air, you can always find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow with more of the conversation.